D. What big event transpired in 1907 in Dublin, Ireland?
I don't know.
We're going to find out. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Empty Promise podcast. My name is Chris, and today you are joining me and my best friend in the whole wide world, Mr. James D. Downey.
Hello!
On episode 138 of the podcast. Tremendous pleasure to be with you on this fine Saturday morning.
The pleasure's all mine.
You're most welcome. And to everybody listening, you are most welcome too. D, today I am taking you on a fantastic journey. It is a wonderful little story. I'm so glad. Before we get into it, I want to talk a little bit about how this came about. We, once again, on our Instagram, if you don't follow us, Empty Promise Podcast on Instagram, put up a poll. I think actually I did it on my page, Empty Promise Chris, and put up a couple of topics for you guys to vote for. Now, you don't yet know what the topic is. I'm sure you have an idea.
No.
We had two front runners. So our three topics to choose from were the theft of the Irish crown jewels. Blackbeard the Pirate, and the history of Winnie the Pooh.
For the fourth week in a row.
Fourth week, and he's still, unfortunately, Winnie the Pooh, he started strong, then he fell to the wayside.
He fell at the first hurdle, yeah. Chris. Now, what are you talking about?
We had well over 100 voters in this poll, which is remarkable, because if you 100 people who voted just listen to the podcast, we get 100 more listens, which would be tremendous. But listen, you voted nonetheless, whether you want to listen to the podcast or not. And we had two front runners out in front. And it came down, in the final hour, it was a tie. It was a tie. And eventually, one topic just etched out in front by a little bit. And we're going to discuss that today. And that is the theft of the Irish crown jewels.
Terrific. I mean, Blackbeard sounds great too.
It does.
But
it
does. This one hits a little bit closer to home.
Well, that's it, Dee. And partly why I enjoyed researching this so much was because it is, to us, it's just down the road. Like, this happened, like, 2 hours away. Yeah. Many years ago.
2 hours away, 200 years ago.
Yeah. But, dude, this is comical. Like, this is a comical tale. And it's not supposed to be comical.
Oh.
It's comical because we, as an Irish civilization,
dropped the ball.
Oh, too much. Like, too much as a whole. Too much.
It's a comedy of errors, Chris.
That's perfect. That's perfect. Let's call this the Comedy of Errors. That's brilliant.
Comedy Errors Podcast.
I don't
rebrand.
Fuck, that's good.
Next week you'll be hearing from us.
That's great, actually.
Keep your ears open.
Yeah, I don't have my book, so I can't write that one down. But keep that in the brain.
Forget. It's gone.
Comedy of Errors.
It's already gone.
You ready to jump into this?
I am.
Ready to start? Okay, yep, here we go. D. So the Irish crown jewels. So the Irish crown jewels were not really referred to as the Irish crown jewels while anybody still knew what they were. So before they were even stolen, they weren't even known as the Irish crown jewels. The name was given to the collection afterward during the wild media coverage of the actual theft. They were technically Irish crown jewels in that they were jewels in Ireland. That was pretty much it. They were owned by the crown, but they were not quite like the English equivalent, which were worn at coronations. So the English would wear all their jewels. These were just, well, I'll tell you exactly what they were. These were an insignia of the most illustrious order of St. Patrick.
Oh.
So these jewels go back a long way.
Oh, I see. Okay. St. Paddy's jewels.
Yeah.
That sounds like something else.
The most important chivalric order in Ireland. And they were worn by the most important person in the order, which was usually the sovereign, at the order's most important ceremonies. There was one guy, he'd wear them at the most important kind of ceremonies. This was a members-only club.
Oh, of course.
Founded in 1783. That's a long time ago.
Yeah, that's wild.
And the English sovereign as its head, it was made up of the highest-ranking members of the Irish aristocracy. I get that word right? Aristocracy?
Aristocracy.
Aristocracy, yeah, perfect. So the jewels themselves were composed of a diamond star of the Grand Master of the Order of St. Patrick, composed of brilliant Brazilian stones of the purest water, 4 5/8 by 4 1/4 inches.
Oof.
I know, it means nothing to us. But it consists of 8 points, 4 greater and 4 lesser. So a nice big star issuing from a center enclosed a number of rubies and trefoil of emerald surrounding a sky blue enamel circle with the words Qui Seprabi MC MDCCLXXXIII in rose diamonds engraved on the back. I'm assuming that means 19 or 1783, maybe.
Aye,
that's gotta be. The value at the time was around £14,000, which equivalent in 2020 would be equivalent to around $1.6 million.
Oof. Yeah.
For this one kind of jewel,
it was basically, this one thing.
It's really, yeah. It's one kind of. It's like a pendant. Okay, such, yeah.
You wear it around your neck.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. That's, I can imagine that in like a ceremonial thing. They're all wearing their fancy robes and stuff, and then they put the ceremonial jewels.
That's it, yeah. Well, this is the thing. These weren't used at ceremonies. They were only worn during this, at this club.
Yeah. So basically, it's a bunch of really rich people who got some jewels together and then show them off to each other.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
Now, the jewels mostly stayed locked in a safe at a jeweller's in Dublin. That jeweller had been the official watchmaker for Queen Victoria herself and valued security tremendously, to the point of counting the spoons they had provided to the royals to ensure none had been stolen.
The spoons?
Spoons.
Because them royals are always stealing fucking spoons.
There you go, yeah. If the king, queen or the representatives visited Ireland and had called to wear the jewels, they would be moved to a safe that sat in Dublin Castle, which was an ancient complex that then served as the seat of government in Ireland, for the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of strange that, like, if a dignitary came to Ireland, they might ask, "I wish to wear the jewels," which is such a weird thing.
Give me the jewels. You know what I mean? But it's like, you know, it's like whenever the Queen visits places, it's like. There's this very ceremonial and shit. So
yeah.
They'd come in in their little horse and cart, and they'd be wearing their jewels. Just
but it's kind of
show the people.
You imagine me going to your house and be like, "Dee, I wish to wear the hat."
Oh yeah,
let's get the hat out.
Yeah, this should be done. There should be a degree of ceremony related to the hat.
It's a strange thing. Like people just acted differently back in the day.
They still do it though, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. The English crown jewels are worn during ceremonies.
Platinum jubilees coming up.
I know, true.
God, you know what they'll be at there.
See, that's why we tied this episode into this.
It's all related. It's all ticked in.
Yeah. Well, the Dublin Castle was full of military and police agents, and it was the headquarters of the Dublin Metropolitan Police, or the DMP.
The DIMP.
That's what I like to call them.
The Dimples.
And here lay the safe in which the jewels were kept, and this safe only had two keys. That was it.
Okay.
Now, who were the keys held by? Because this is where we start getting important. This
Grand Order of St. Patrick, head guy, and the owner of the shop.
Oh, not a bad guess.
Okay, but wrong, I'm guessing.
Okay, yeah. the keys were actually held by a single man.
Both keys?
Both, yeah.
See, that's where you're meant,
This is where we start to slip up a little bit, okay? Arthur Vickers was his name, and he was 45 years old in July 1907, just a few weeks after his birthday. This is when everything started to go wrong.
Okay.
His entire life at the time was wrapped up in his job as Ulster King of Arms.
Okay.
This put him in charge of the rules and regulations regarding heraldry and family trees, a very important position in the early 20th century Ireland, because everybody basically inherited like names from their families and they inherited everything.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was in charge of kind of divvying out and making sure those who were entitled to something held.
You claim you're of this family.
Pretty much. So his position was a really powerful position at the time. In addition to a seat in Parliament, Vickers, from his spacious office in Dublin Castle, was well paid, well respected, and very passionate about heraldic history and genealogy.
Okay.
So he's really into his job, this dude.
Okay? Makes sense then.
Yeah. He was almost universally described as a pedant and nitpicker, who wore one of his keys on a chain around his neck or in his pocket at all times, and the other key he hid in his home in Dublin. The castle, and especially Bedford Tower, where the jewel safe was located, was considered one of the most impregnable, well-defended, and heavily observed buildings on the island.
Well.
So, I actually have a quote from the New York Times from 1907, which describes Bedford Tower in Ireland. And they said, Bedford Tower is what is the one building in the castle into which the most enterprising burglar would find it hopeless to effect an entrance unobserved. This place is guarded to the tits. Like, you will not get in here. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like this is all heading towards disaster. Like, as soon as you say it's unsinkable ship, we all know what's happening. Impregnable fortress?
Yeah.
No, not happening.
Well, the summer of 1907 had been a super busy summer for the Irish aristocracy?
Aristocracy.
Aristocracy. Sorry. I'm going to fuck up that word many times during this podcast.
I hope I'm not wrong.
No, you're right. That sounds perfect. It's like the aristocrats.
Yeah.
And government, which were often one and the same. The Irish International Exhibition, which was a grand world's fair, had opened in May and was scheduled to run through November. This massive event featured a Japanese tea garden and an entire Somali village among hundreds of exhibits and drew around 2.5 million visitors during this run. That's huge.
What?
Because even nowadays, if Ireland hosted something, I don't know, we'd get 2.5 million. Yeah, that's crazy. Like,
that's wild.
So King Edward VII, Queen Alexandra, and Princess Victoria were due to visit on July 10th to make an appearance at the exhibition and perform some various royal duties. So probably just a nice wave and maybe say a few words, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But the political relationship between Ireland and Great Britain was fraught with a rising tide of Irish nationalism competing with unionists who wanted to remain loyal to the crown. There had already been a debate about how Irish or British the international exhibition should be. There were separate pavilions for Ireland and Great Britain, and the Irish War of Independence would erupt just over a decade later. So we're already paving the way for all of our lovely history.
Yes, I was going to say, it's lovely how things haven't really changed.
Exactly. On top of this, Dee, the king's nephew, so King Edward's nephew, Kaiser Wilhelm II of Prussia.
Oh my gosh.
What a name.
I know who it is too.
Do you?
Yeah, he kicks off a little... there's a little conflict that happens in Germany.
In Germany?
Yeah.
Yes. We're
around 19, I think it's 14.
Well, we're actually going to touch on that in a little bit, I think.
I actually got pretty big. Got pretty global.
Did it? Yeah.
It did.
A scandal, you would say?
No, like a war.
Oh, okay. Well, we're going to talk about a little
scandal.
More like
a world war.
Well, Kaiser Wilhelm II of Prussia had just months before endured a massive political scandal. King Edward himself was very sensitive to controversy, and he needed this visit to Ireland to go smoothly.
Gosh.
It did not.
Of course it didn't.
Okay. So we're set now. Are you looking up this king at the minute?
Yeah, I just want to make sure that he's the
person. Please do, look him up. It'll give me a time to take a little sip of my coffee here.
Yeah, no, he started the World War. That's right.
He started the World War.
Isn't it? Yeah, or was he the one who got assassinated? No, it was
Arch. No, that was Arch... Ferdinand, who got assassinated.
Yeah, Wilhelm II. Yeah, he was led Germany through the First World War.
Holy shiza.
Some base he is.
Didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, go. Yeah, well, that's when I heard it. I was like,
God.
But, you know, that's kind of, that's like secondary to what, you know, what he's well known for.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, this.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, this political scandal. Well, the. So, as I just said, he needed this visit to go well, and it didn't go well. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about the location, okay? So, at around 1901, so I don't mean at around, not a time, in 1901, sorry, it was decided that the office of the Ulster King of Arms would be moved to deeper within the complex of Dublin Castle from Birmingham Tower to Bedford Tower. So this was Vickers, this was his position, okay?
Yeah.
And he was delighted at this, because he then proposed to the government that he should get a free apartment in the new building and that he should also, that the safe holding the jewels should be housed in a strong room.
Okay. Within his apartment?
Within this complex, Bedford Tower, okay?
Okay.
Now, the board of works at Dublin Castle didn't give him the free apartment, naturally, because you're not getting anything free in Ireland.
Yeah, that's a great idea, yeah.
But they liked the idea of the strong room.
Okay.
In fact, they were very much in favour of a strong room to hold the safe, because it would also hold the jewels and it could serve as a place to hold the castle's collection of valuable manuscripts.
Oh, okay.
So this is where we start getting into like true Irish, like just idiocracy.
Dumb fuckery.
The workers who renovated the New Bedford Tower. So this was the Irish Board of, I forget the name, the Irish Board of, not workers, but it's a, basically they did all big jobs.
Big jobs.
Big fit out company, basically. Okay. they were meant to move the safe into this brand new strong room, but they found that their measurements were all wrong.
Oh, I see.
The safe, they had a doorway. So they had a safe here, the big safe here. They had a doorway, and in behind that doorway lay the strong room. They had to move one. Instead of moving the safe first, they fitted out the new doorway and realized, yeah, we can't get the safe through. Okay?
Oh, God.
Having already endured months of renovations and faced with the possibility of having to knock down the new walls to fit the safe through, and go through a ton of like red tape and legislation and blah, blah, blah. Vickers and the Board of Works decided enough was enough. They opted to place the safe in the library.
Oh, no.
Can you see how we're already starting? This is...
So it was in a safe room.
It was in a safe room.
They took it out of the safe room and put it into the strong room.
But the strong room couldn't fit it because they made the doorway too small.
So they put it in the library.
They just goes, we'll put it in the library. And you know what we'll do? We'll just put it in the library and we'll put a sentry on duty at all time. And that'll be fine.
No, you know what they should have done? Should put some books in front of it.
Just put books, cover it up.
Yeah. Hide in plain sight.
Put books that nobody wants back
exactly,
at that time.
Exactly.
Books relating to homosexual acts, perhaps. Which we're going to... No. It's all relative because we're going to touch on that soon.
How many books were written about that, Chris? 19-0, whatever.
We're going to touch on that too. It's all relative, you know? So, this would be the best solution to their doorway problem. Besides, this was a huge, heavy safe, and it wasn't going to go anywhere. And it was designed to be burglar-proof anyway. So, according to the correspondence of the chairman of the Board of Works. So, in 1905, Vickers wrote some revised statutes for his office, which included stipulations that the jewels must be kept in the safe, which must be kept in a strong room. Vickers seemed to have been really, really passionate about the heraldry, and... he was also super annoyed because he now had to stand guard over these jewels at all times, which was a big job because it's a stressful job. It's Ireland's most prominent piece of jewellery. It's their crown jewels. And several writers have described Vickers at this time as a completely happy man existing upon the very edge of a volcano. The library in question wasn't exactly tucked away. It was also the waiting room for Vickers' office. Okay, so this library served as the waiting room for Vickers' office, which meant
a lot of foot traffic.
Which meant there was always a steady stream of visitors hanging out in the same room as the jewels. The library also had several doorways leading in and out of it, not all of which were guarded, and the safe that was put into the room, the sentry who was on guard, couldn't actually see the safe from their position.
Of course not.
Yeah.
Because that makes too much sense.
Can you see how flawed this was?
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Well... I can also see how they were like, it's fine.
It's fine.
Like, we have a sentry on guard. It's a safe that's designed not to be broken.
It's super heavy, so it can't be moved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When you think about it, the library isn't that bad because there's lots of people going through the library all the time.
Who's gonna steal them?
Exactly. How are you going to sneak it out?
So we're going to flash forward a little bit to 1907. So the jewels were kept in this library in the safe until this time. But now we move into the heist.
I love a heist.
In summer 1907, security at Bedford Tower experienced a series of escalating incidents. They were all ignored.
Uh-oh.
On June 28th, Vickers discovered that his key to the front of Bedford Tower was missing. A guard had to let him in, which was really unusual because Vickers was a man of pride and a man who, you know, he loved his job. He would always have his keys on. Bit strange, but anyway.
He was particular.
He was particular, yeah. On July 3rd, a Mrs. Farrell, who cleaned Vickers' office, found that the front door was unlocked. She told the sentry, who told Vickers, and Vickers did nothing. He did not check the safe. He did not ask a locksmith to change the locks either. This was considered rather unusual for a man known to be prissy, particular, and detail-oriented. Yeah. On the morning of July 6th, that same Mrs. Farrell, on her cleaning rounds, found that the outer door to the strong room, the one that didn't contain the jewels, was also unlocked. The inner door was still locked, but not very well. The key was still sitting in the lock, on a ring, with other keys. She wrote a note for the sentry, whose name was Stevie, or Stivey, let's call him Stivey, and left the keys for him. When Stivey read the note, he took a look around the strong room, found nothing amiss, and waited for Vickers to come in to tell him what had happened.
Okay.
Nothing, didn't really find anything unusual with this, despite the fact keys were left in the door.
Like the strong room and the fucking secure parts of the building were like sitting unlocked.
So Vickers was still stressed about this king's upcoming visit. Remember I previously mentioned?
Oh yeah, Wilhelm.
Yeah. And again took little notice and proceeded up the stairs to his desk. Later that same day, a messenger arrived from West and Son. They had been doing some alterations to one of the gold collars used by a member of the Order of St. Patrick, which was normally stored in the safe with the crown jewels. The completed piece was ready, and the messenger was delivering it. Vickers, engulfed in his work, handed Stevie a key and told him to go down to the library and place the gold collar into the safe. Stevie placed the key into the lock and was confounded. The key would not turn in the direction it was supposed to, so he turned the key the other way and tried the handle. But the safe wouldn't open. It was locked, and realization came to him.
Mm-mm.
If turning the key that way had locked the safe, then that must mean before he arrived...
It was open.
It was already open.
Uh-oh.
Stevie ran straight back to Vickers' office and told him that the safe had been unlocked. Vickers followed him to the library, opened the safe, and found that nearly everything was gone. All of the gold collars worn by the Knights of the Order of St. Patrick, gone. A case containing a bunch of jewels owned by the Mahoney family into which Vickers' own mother had married, gone. And the Irish crown jewels, gone. Everything was gone, except there was a ribbon. There was still a ribbon.
A ribbon.
So the badge of the Irish crown jewels had a very small hook that was attached to a sky blue ribbon. The ribbon was mounted on a hook by a clasp and fastened with two very small finickety screws. A thief could simply have yanked the badge out, most likely breaking the clasp, but who cares about a ribbon clasp when you're stealing a jewel badge worth millions anyway. But the ribbon was still in its box, still in the safe, and it had been carefully unscrewed and removed from the badge. Vickers estimated that this task could not have been done in less than 10 minutes. He was likely exaggerating, but it certainly would have required some effort. In addition, all of the tissue paper and cloth holding the various jewels in their boxes and valuables had been refolded and placed back into their boxes.
Oh, so it wasn't just everything sitting in the open, like it was all in boxes and stuff?
This was no smash and grab job.
Yeah.
Okay? This was downright fastidious.
Particular, you might say.
So, yeah. Mm. And who do we know that's particular?
Who has the key?
Mm-hmm. In the middle of committing the biggest heist... Why would a thief take that much time and that much care in the middle of committing the biggest heist in Irish history up until this point?
Yeah. I can't. Yeah, and then they left the ribbon.
Yeah.
So, like, why not just take the ribbon and then do all of that busy work later?
If you're going to smash and grab something...
Smash and grab!
Just take the whole lot. Whatever you can get.
You don't need
ribbons,
to be,
boxes,
you don't need
tissue
to be
paper... Exactly. You don't need to be neat.
It's a package deal. Yeah, that's weird.
Okay. So it is strange, yeah. So now we move to the keys. So Vickers immediately called the DMP, the Dublin Metropolitan Police. They found that the doors of the front door of the tower and the strong room and the safe had not been forced, and none of the telltale scratches would indicate a hastily copied key.
Huh.
Okay. So it would have taken a few days to make a proper key, but that was only one of two possibilities. Either the locks had been opened by professional copies or someone had the original keys.
Exactly. And who lost their keys recently?
Well, that's, yeah, exactly. There were seven keys in the front of the Bedford Tower held by Vickers, Stevie, Mrs. Farrell, and a few others who worked in or around the Office of Arms.
Okay.
There were four keys to the outer door of the strong room, two keys to the inner door, and two keys to the safe. All keys within each set were identical. Okay, so the keys to the safe were identical. The keys to the strong room doors, identical.
Mm-hmm.
So who had access to the keys, just briefly? The strong room door keys, the four strong room door keys, one went to Vickers, one went to Stevie, one went to Vickers' assistant, who was his nephew. What about this for a name? Pierce Gunn Mahoney.
Oh, that is a good name.
Isn't it? And Vickers' Old secretary had the other one. Of the two strong room door keys, Stevie... One in Vickers' office upstairs, that and one that was habitually kept in the locked door itself, except when Stevie left his post. And of the two keys to the safe, Vickers carried one in his person at all time, and he hid the other one at his home. So the investigation. Upon the discovery of the theft, the king's visit to Dublin Castle was postponed, and he was furious. Politically, this was a huge embarrassment. These things were emblematic of British rule in Ireland. So their loss became a symbolic of the disappearance of the British reigns of Ireland.
Yeah, okay? That's true. Yeah.
A reward for 1,000 was issued, although it was never claimed. So at that, it's that, well, that 1,000 is about 140,000 today.
Oof.
So it's quite a bit of money. Yeah. The Dublin police began investigating, but got nowhere. So the big guns were called in. Scotland Yard were called in. I didn't even know Scotland Yard existed back then.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It's really fucking old, that thing.
An inspector named John Keane arrived on July 12th, and after his investigation, he sent to the Dublin police a report identifying who he thought had committed the theft. Keane was Irish himself, and he was convinced that it had been an inside job. He was particularly obsessed with the sky blue ribbon. Keane's report was roundly rejected by the Dublin police, and Keane and his team were sent back to London immediately.
I love that. It's like, let's bring in the big boys to do this investigation proper. Yeah. They come out with their response. They're like, no, fuck off.
Fuck off. Back to England.
Back to London.
Yeah. Yeah.
This kind of crack might fly over there, but we know what we're doing here in Dublin.
And that report had never been found, never been filed, and never been found out.
Oh, no, so we don't know who he thought it was. Oh, man.
I know.
I'm very interested to know.
So newspapers at the time declared this as an obvious indication of a cover-up. Keane had found too much, an answer that was unpalatable to those in power, and so he was taken off the case.
Okay.
So Vickers during this time maintained that nobody on his staff would have done such a thing. He swore by that.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And the crown jewels might well show up on their own. That's what he kept saying. The crown jewels might give it time. They'll show up. You know.
Say a wee person.
That's it. See, that's it.
No problem. You'll find it. You'll come across it.
The substantial reward, as might be expected, led to plenty of tips, plenty of tip offs, and plenty of dead ends, basically.
Yeah.
People were seeing this 140, well, 1,000 at the time, and thinking, oh, yeah, sure, seeing them in the bin there in Dublin and O'Connell Street High, you know?
No problem.
But one went directly to Vickers himself. A woman working at the exhibition sent him a letter stating that her daughter had visions about the theft. Oh, Vickers was intrigued, but sensitive to the weirdness of the optics. So this whole visions thing, he wasn't convinced by this whole, you know? So he asked his good friend, Mr. Francis Shackleton.
Okay, is that the Lieutenant of Ireland? No?
Remember we did Ernest Shackleton, the boat?
Yeah.
This is his brother.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because you did mention that.
I did.
He was like, what is he? What's his title or whatever?
Sir Francis Shackleton. Okay, I'll get into it now. To contact her and set up a seance. So a seance.
Oh,
like
my
a,
God.
Like a, yeah.
Oh,
so they're going into
this
like,
has taken a turn, Chris.
Isn't it? Yeah.
That happened fast.
Didn't it?
So, we just went from having the goddamn Scotland Yard in here.
To now we're going to a
seance.
Seance.
God.
Tell us where the jewels are, you know?
Oh, my Lord.
So that's where we are. This is how it went so very wrong for the DMP, for Vickers, for everybody involved.
All right, excellent.
So, just a bit briefly on Francis. Francis Shackleton was the brother of Ernest Shackleton, who was a mega celebrity in Britain at the time for his voyages to the Antarctic, which we covered in a previous episode, if you wish to listen to.
Check it out.
Always nice to plug your own stuff during your own show.
Oh, absolutely.
Francis was an incredibly charming man, handsome and clever and witty, and operated as a man about town in the upper echelons of both Dublin and London society. Okay, so he's very well-to-do guy.
I see, yes.
He was a stockbroker of sorts, but it's unclear whether he was actually good at it, because he had gone bankrupt at least once.
and most stockbrokers are a bit like that, aren't they?
Partying seemed to be more of an interest to him than his actual job. So at the seance, Vickers told him that the jewels had been buried at a cemetery outside town, in a town outside of Dublin. The spiritualist was not perfectly clear. Her instructions could have applied to either of one of two cemeteries. So Vickers, eager to find these jewels, dug around several tombstones in the cemetery. Yeah, it's going downhill fast for Vickers. You don't do that. No. You don't just go digging up tombstones in people's graves.
The plot has been lost a wee bit there.
A wee bit. So no jewels were found, by the way, which makes it even worse.
The seance was wrong?
But this story did make it into the press, which made Vickers a greater subject of mockery than he had already become. So let's talk a little bit here about the staff and the suspects. So Shackleton himself spent most of his time in London, but he did come to Dublin sometimes and had an arrangement with Vickers to stay at his house when he did. In fact, despite only spending a month or so in Dublin per year, Shackleton would regularly pay half of Vickers' rent and his bills. And it was assumed he did this because Vickers was the type of man that liked to throw about his money to kind of show, oh, look yeah, at me, I'm yeah. quite well off.
I know, can afford to do this, no problem.
Pretty much, yeah. Shackleton was also widely known to be gay. And this was at a time when this was completely taboo in yeah. Irish society, not to mention illegal.
Uh-huh,
it was legal.
And he was staying with his friend in Dublin.
Exactly.
I see. Okay.
However, you can get away with most things when you have money, mm-hmm. especially back then. Okay. Even nowadays, I guess. But Shackleton's lover was a man named Captain Richard Gorgeous.
You're joking.
Dick Gorgeous.
Dick Gorgeous.
Dick Gorgeous. Oh, he's got a gorgeous dick.
Lad, what is this story?
I know. Richard Gorgeous.
It's like Dublin or Metropolitan Police doing an official investigation. Seance. Dick Gorgeous. This is crazy. That's good.
It's great. Whose service to South Africa was described as violent, bullying, and criminal by an Irish Member of Parliament.
Holy fuck.
Gorgeous had somewhat prominent military man, would have been known to the Secretary Security Forces at Dublin Castle, so he was known.
Okay.
Also in Shackleton's social service was Lord Ronald Gower, an aristocratic sculptor and biographer who would have implicated in a raid on a male brothel in 1890 and who is generally believed to have been the inspiration for a few of Oscar Wilde's characters. Another was John Campbell, the Duke of Argyll, who was heavily rumoured to be gay as well and who was definitively the king's brother-in-law. And Shackleton was also connected. So this whole kind of homosexual thing kind of floated around. And Vickers was kind of caught up in it as well, which wasn't seen as very promising. Okay.
So these are all associates of Shackleton, and Vickers is also an associate of Shackleton.
Yeah.
And the optics aren't good.
They're
as
not
you said.
Good at all.
I see.
The next person in this kind of in the group of staff or suspects was Vickers' nephew, Pierce Gunn Mahoney.
Oh,
great name.
Old Gunn Mahoney.
Yeah, a decade younger than Vickers, Mahoney belonged to a very old and very wealthy Irish clan, which allowed him to live a life of leisure. Vickers and his half-brother, Pierce's father, also named Pierce, were close despite their differing politics. Vickers was a unionist, and the elder Mahoney was an ardent nationalist who served in Parliament. As a favour to his half-brothers, Vickers gave his nephew an honorary position, which would confer some status within Dublin society. The younger Mahoney had a few responsibilities, but felt a great deal of loyalty towards Vickers for the gift of this job, and his title was Cork Herald. An earnest young man, Mahoney spent much of his time in England, but still spent more time in the office of the Ulster King of Arms than Shackleton did.
Okay.
Then we have Francis Benet Goldney, who was a descendant from a line of antiquities and scholars, which made him very wealthy as well. So all, His family collected and expanded upon their own purchases, which was impressive at the time. He eventually displayed much of it in a museum in Canterbury. Benet Goldney ended up the honorary director of a museum as a result of the donations and activity, and moved to Canterbury himself, where he was elected to the House of Commons. However, Benet Goldney was an ambitious and direct man, used to getting what he wanted. He met Vickers in 1905, and Vickers was only really interested as antiquities as a means to learn about family trees. Because remember, he loved all this kind of stuff. While Benet Goldney was more of a generalist, he outright asked Vickers for a position within the office of the Ulster King of Arms. But Vickers kind of said, you know, you need proper recommendations to get in here. I can't just give you a position.
Yeah, okay.
You know, the Duke of Bedford supplied the recommendation, but had took a while for Benet Goldney to achieve this position, which was known as the Athlone Pursuivant.
Perfect.
Good name.
Good to have.
An
Athlonian Pursuivant.
And he was officially sworn in 1907, just 2 months before the theft. Okay, he was...
We're on to you, Benet Goldstein.
This guy also possessed a secret that nobody would discover until his death.
Oh, God.
And we'll talk a little bit about that in just a little bit, because okay. We're getting there. So following the theft, the king demanded that Vickers resign immediately. Wasn't happy with this, okay?
I mean, he did do some stupid stuff, didn't he? Didn't look good.
Didn't look good. But Vickers refused, saying that he had done nothing wrong and blamed the Board of Works for their screw-up with the whole the safe is too big for the doorway thing in the first place. Vickers wanted his story to be heard and to defend himself in a public, in as public a venue as he could create. So he asked for a royal commission, which was a trial in which he could call witnesses to defend his own name. So he wasn't going down without a fight. He was like, fuck no. Yeah. He's like, the people will take my side. They'll see that you fucked up and I'll come out clean. He was refused this trial. So he was refused and instead given a sham visceral commission trial, which allowed no witnesses, barred the public and press, and took as its mandate not an investigation of the crime, but of Vickers' performance of his actual duties. So they didn't even look at the crime. They kind of just looked at, which was a bit shitty, like, to be fair. So Vickers and his lawyers, upon hearing these terms, silently stood up and just walked out of the courtroom without a glance. Didn't even wait for the trial.
Yeah.
However, they carried it out in his absence. And based upon the statutes he had written for himself in 1905, basically he failed the duties that he himself had set out for himself when he wrote those new statutes and he was fired.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Fired from his post.
But that was always going to be the outcome of that trial. Like, regardless.
However, Vickers was offered a full pension, but only if he stopped asking for a public trial. Why did they want to just let this all blow over?
Cover it up.
There we go. So Vickers' nephew was all in. So this guy, Pierce Gunn Mahoney, was all into defending Vickers. That's my uncle. Like, I will defend him. And he used every tool at his disposal. Remember, he's a wealthy guy. He has a lot of reach, okay? So he reached out to members of Parliament that he knew. And when Mahoney asked why they declined to help, he was told that Vickers was known to have associated with men of undesirable character. Okay? So a massive scandal in Germany in 1906 and 1907, which we talked about before, with the German journalist Maximilian Harden. What great names in this story. A fierce critic of Kaiser Wilhelm, which was the king's nephew that we talked about, repeatedly accused several members of the Kaiser's cabinet and social circle of homosexual acts. Right. So the king's nephew, this Kaiser Wilhelm, had been accused of homosexual acts, which caused huge scandal. Accusations bounced back and forth, and many within the Kaiser's inner circle, not the Kaiser, but within Kaiser's inner circle, were forced to resign. Wilhelm was King Edward's nephew, and although Edward hated Wilhelm and probably enjoyed his struggles, he absolutely did not want to suffer any kind of scandal himself. He wanted this all to be gone, get rid of it. So Mahoney sat down with a publisher of a newspaper for a nice luncheon and told the publisher a story. Now this is ridiculous.
Oh God.
Vickers, he told the newspaper reporter that Vickers was a legendary lightweight of a drinker. Couldn't hold his drink.
Okay.
And he would often throw parties at the Bedford Tower. And these parties were just that. They were just parties. They weren't these orgies that he said he was having.
Okay.
They were just parties. But at the end of these parties, Vickers got so drunk that he passed out in his office, and his drinking buddies got themselves an idea. They rifled through his clothes and found the keys to the safe. They went downstairs to the library, opened the safe, took out the crown jewels, tiptoed back upstairs, and replaced the keys where they had found them. Knowing this, the newspaper writer said, "Is it so hard to believe that someone could have swiped the key to the safe for a real theft?"
Yeah.
You know? Like all scandals...
No doubt.
Yeah. Well, like all scandals, this one and its monumental implications soon began to blow over in the Irish and Irish-American newspapers. So it eventually started to fade away. No one really cared anymore. The New York Times ran many stories, mostly little updates on the latest gossip, including the suggestion that the British government was hushing up the crime for fear of scandal.
Mm.
The government tactics eventually worked, and the stories faded out of the headlines, and the reward was never claimed. The tips became increasingly preposterous, and the jewels remain missing over a century later.
Oh, really?
Mm-mm-mm.
Ooh, I thought we were gonna find out what happened.
No, but we do have. I have some theories just to rattle through before we finish up as to where
they are,
where these jewels are. So theory number one: Francis Shackleton plans the theft. He always needs money and is regularly borrowing and failing to repay from his rich friends. He lives an expensive lifestyle. He testifies in 1907 that he's so broke that he had to borrow money from a loan shark. Shackleton, the theory is that Shackleton breaks the crown jewels apart, popping out the jewels and melting down the metal for an anonymous sale in Antwerp or Amsterdam. Some believe that this was the conclusion of the report from Keane, the Scotland Yard detective.
Oh.
And they were like, no, get rid of that. Because no. Money kind of covers everything up, and he was sent away. Theory number two is that Shackleton did do that, but is blackmailed. His homosexuality is widely known in polite society, but is very different from, say, a scandalous article being published in a newspaper. He relies on a delicate balance of silence, risk, and elitism to survive. In exchange for mystery, Shackleton uses his access and knowledge to procure one of Vickers' keys, but does not participate in the crimes beyond that. So he gets the key, gives it to whoever he's given it to, and that's it. The king and his cronies hush up to the theft, owning to Shackleton's involvement.
Yeah, okay. Covering one of their own.
Theory number three, unionists steal. Theory number four, nationalists steal.
Oh, right, okay.
there was so much with theory three and four, I just didn't want to get stuck into it. Yeah. Basically, number three, the unionists stole it. Number four, the nationalists stole it. Can't have one without the other. But the group of nationalists want to embrace the king and demonstrate what a farce English rule is over Ireland. That's where that theory kind of came from.
I get you. Because, that's one of their concerns, was this, like, you just lost, like, a symbol of
British reign over Ireland. Yeah. So theory number five is that Binet Goldie, the guy I talked about before, according to several reports, remember I said he had a secret to hide that wouldn't
emerge?
Yeah. So his secret was, according to several reports, that he was a thief.
Oh, right.
A very prominent thief, and something that was not discovered until well after his death. While preparing for the late Binet Goldie's belongings for auction, ancient manuscripts found from the city of Canterbury were found in his house, along with a fairly valuable painting. Only Bennett Goldney could have taken the manuscripts, owing to his privileged position as mayor when he was elected to that little town.
Right.
So then perhaps Bennett Goldney obtains the key either by himself or with the aid of Shackleton. He creates an alibi, heads out of Dublin, orchestrates the theft, and then just a few months after joining Vickers' crew of honorary assistants, perhaps this is done with the aid of Shackleton and Gorges, perhaps not, but that's the theory. Binet Goldie, however, is not generally suspected. He has an airtight alibi and is known to be quite wealthy and not in need of any cash. This allows him to subtly steer the investigation. However, his remarks to detectives are coy and ambiguous, but point them to Shackleton and his sexuality. So whenever he's kind of questioning stuff, he kind of veers off and goes, no, it was that boy there, Shackleton. They love orgies up in that tower.
He's gay. Get him.
So basically, it all came to a dead end. The jewels were never recovered. And we have some kind of untimely ends, basically. We're going to tie this up now with what kind of happened.
What about my boy Vickers?
Well, here we go. So Francis Shackleton, firstly, declared bankruptcy in 1910, owning the astounding amount of $85,000, which is well over $10 million in currency in 2020.
How?
Just ridiculous. He fled to Portuguese West Africa, but was there accused of cashing a widow's checks, sent back to London, and sentenced to 15 months of hard labour. In 1913, he was charged with conspiring to steal hundreds of thousands of dollars from his old friend, Lord Ronald Gower, by purchasing stocks that didn't even exist and pocketing the money. He changed his name and moved in with his sister and then died broke.
Oh, God, there you go.
Which is a far cry from Ernest Shackleton, who was a hero until the end of his days, basically.
Exactly, Well, that's where a flamboyant lifestyle can lead you, Chris.
Yeah. Let's talk about Big Dick Gorgeous. He fell into hard alcoholism.
God.
And fell in hard line with nationalists and began both drinking from morning until night and carrying a revolver around his pocket at all times.
And a boy.
Eventually, detectives tracked him down for illegal sexual practices. A scuffle erupted in his house that Gorgeous was renting, and he fatally shot one of the officers in the chest. He served 12 years in prison for manslaughter, and while there, he attempted to use supposed knowledge of the theft to gain release. His information was ignored, and he was released in 1925. One source says he was struck and killed by a train at London shortly after confessing to a theft in 1944, and that coroners could not identify whether he was killed by accident, suicide, or homicide.
Oh, God, right. Mm. So, not another unfortunate end.
Yeah. Oh, these are all pretty unfortunate. Oh. Like, all these guys, they don't really...
Okay.
Gearscon Mahoney moved into a family home in County Kerry, where he remained close with Vickers. Mahoney... Let me see. In 1914, Mahoney was due to have tea with some neighbours. He planned to get there by rowing a boat across a pond... And as the pond had many waterfowl, Mahoney took a shotgun with him.
Oh God!
His body was discovered the next day near the boathouse, and he had been shot himself. He had been shot through the heart. Foul play has often been suggested, but neither has been proven or disproven.
Sorry, just the way he went duck hunting, I think it was found the next day. I was like, "What?"
Yeah,
but that's sad if he did it himself. Or if, I mean, obviously sad as well if he was murdered.
Exactly. You know, Francis Manet Goley then was elected to Parliament in 1910 and in 1917 was
appointed... He is a thief after all.
...appointed attaché in Paris. In 1918, he was involved in an unspecified motoring accident and died of a renal hemorrhage. A year later, his secret life as a thief was revealed.
There you go.
Now, Arthur Vickers, our boy Arthur... was disgraced, fired from the job that was his life work, and left penniless after he refused a pension that seemed to him
a
harsh harmony.
Yes.
He relied on money from his brother-in-law and a bit of cash that he got from suing the Daily Mail for libel. The paper admitted that it had invented a story about Vickers' mistress being behind the theft. He insisted on his innocence to his death, and even his will showed that he never got over the incident. During his later years at one of his relatives' houses, he continued to act as a unionist, even offering food and shelter to British soldiers who, by the 1920s, patrolled the countryside. Vickers was warned against doing this, and in 1921, around 30 armed men broke into his home, pulled him from his bed, and shot him several times. A sign was placed around his neck which read, "Spy, informers beware, IRA never forgets."
Yeah. 1921,
and thus ends the story, or the all that is left to be said about the theft of the Irish Crown Jewels. Still undiscovered.
Who was it? It was the fucking thief. Well, maybe not. I don't know. Shackleton.
It could have been the maid who was cleaning the rooms.
Yeah. A note to everybody.
I genuinely think it could have been Gearscon Mahoney, the nephew.
You think?
I do. He was close to
Vickers. But he's so loyal to him, Chris.
Yeah, but he just seems like a kid who...
And he didn't do well afterwards.
He didn't do well. But maybe he wanted to clear his name, clear some debts, something like that. Maybe it could have been Shackleton either. Fuck, it could have been Vickers. Who knows?
I don't think it was Vickers, because he turned down his pension and all.
Yeah, but maybe
that... You would have just taken it at that point, I think. Because if you had them, you know. I think it was Shackleton.
You think it was Shackleton?
Because like he seems like one of those people, he lives with a sword and he dies with a sword. He stole it, he melted it down, he tried to invest it in something, it went to shit, it was all gone.
Yeah.
And then 6 years later, he's 10 million in debt somehow.
That's true, actually, yeah. And he died penniless and broke.
That's wild.
Crazy, like crazy story. It took so many turns, and it all ultimately came back to that board of works who just couldn't put the fucking safe into the right room.
Jesus Christ, like.
Things could have been so different.
Could have been. You know? Well, I mean, here's the thing. If it was Vickers or Shackleton, or if whoever did it had Vickers' keys, then it wouldn't have mattered where it was, because you would have been able to open those doors regardless. So I'll stand up a little bit for the Irish Board of Works, because they're the only ones here who probably aren't rich bastards. everyone else is rich as fuck, and I don't really feel bad for them, to be honest.
True. I don't feel bad for Vickers either, after all that shit. I mean,
he still came from money, like.
Yeah, and he wrote all those new statues into his proposed plan and then didn't abide by them.
Well,
you know what I mean?
I mean, listen, if he was throwing parties and getting drunk, passing out with the keys in his pocket, like,
and the keys were left in the safe when it was discovered, do you know what I mean? Come on. That's why I think he never rushed whenever the keys were first discovered in the safe. I think maybe the night before could have been a rough one for him. You know, the king was visiting, he was stressed. Let's have a couple of drinks, relax.
Sat yourself.
Get a couple of guys in the Bedford Tower.
See, maybe that's why he also knew it was them what did it.
And he couldn't say anything.
Yeah.
Because it was like, so
he's like, taboo. I know the keys are missing. I'm aware. I know who fucking talked them, but I can't say.
I know we had all the boys up here last night, but we can't say that because I'll be imprisoned. Big story. As far as stories in like Dublin and Ireland go, that's big.
Yeah. I mean, that's how much? A million quid worth of...
Yeah, of jewels. 1.5 million. Jewels? Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Not to be said. But listen, that's it. That's all we got time for this week. So we hope that you have enjoyed the theft of the crown jewels. If you have, please leave a little like or a little thumbs up rating on this podcast wherever you listen to it. Remember, you can find us on all podcast hosting services. Be sure to give us a follow over on the social media sites, which are Twitter and Instagram. Just search for Empty Promise Podcast, or Empty Promise Chris is myself, and I'll keep you up to date on my page with everything that goes on with the podcast. Get in contact with us, send us your questions, comments, and queries. We love to hear from you, and thank you to each and every one of you who listen on a weekly basis. We will see you all next time. Goodbye and God bless.
Bye-bye.